Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome everyone to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jane McMillan, a news anchor reporter for KCBS, All News 740 AM. And this is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker tonight. How many of us wonder about how our seemingly ordinary lives might one day intersect with the extraordinary? When we get up in the morning to what? Deliver mail, chase a virus out of a computer, do traffic and weather together every 10 minutes. What are the chances that what we're doing is going to affect change or become a rich life experience? Well, after hearing about the Kabul Beauty School, I think now, for me, the answer is you just never know. And this is the beauty of this story. Mother of two sons from Michigan, background in hairdressing, soon after the fall of the Taliban in 2001, Deborah Rodriguez went to Afghanistan as part of a group offering humanitarian aid to this war-torn country. Surrounded by men and women whose skills as doctors and nurses and therapists seem so much more real and more practical and more important than her own, Rodriguez, a hairdresser again, despaired of being of use. However, she found she had a gift for befriending Afghans, and once her profession became known, she was sought out by Afghanistan women and Westerners alike who were there. You can imagine the rich life experience this brought her. And the idea was born for the Kabul Beauty School. With the help of corporate donations, international sponsors, and funding and supplies, she was able to welcome the first class in 2003. How this ends? Well, still unknown at this time. It's not always the happiest of circumstances, but it, to me, the value here is this an incredibly rich experience that we get to hear about. And so I would like to ask you to welcome Deborah Rodriguez, author of The Kabul Beauty School, An American Woman Goes Behind the Veil. Thank you, Deborah. We're going to get started. I just want to ask the basic question. How did you get from there, Michigan, to there, Kabul, Afghanistan?
I've been a hairdresser. My mother's a hairdresser. My son's a hairdresser. One of my husbands was a hairdresser. And I was getting a bit, I don't want to say bored, but I felt like I could do more. And so I started doing this thing called Vacation with a Purpose. So I would raise money. I literally, you guys have Costco's here. We had Sam's Club. So I would have all my customers bake brownies and cookies. I'd go outside Sam's Club and I'd sell them. And I'd have my little tip jar out. And I would raise money, and then I would go to India and put a well in. And it just started to be something as simple as that, Vacation with a Purpose. And then I decided to start training with disaster relief. So I started doing disaster relief, and it was August 2001, and I just had finished training. And I went to Singapore. I was on my way back from India when 9/11 happened. And it was in Singapore when it happened, so I couldn't leave the country. And I was on one of the first flights out. And I got home. I was, as devastated like everybody and shocked. And I got home to a message going, Debbie, we need you at Ground Zero. And I'm thinking, I'm there. And so I got on the plane and worked with the firefighters. And it was the hardest thing I probably ever did. It was a bunch of girls. They needed debriefing. But they were not accepting it from, therapists. And we had basic training in debriefing. We had learned that in Oklahoma City bombing about how first responders have a hard time with, the turning to alcoholism and, drug abuse, just different not good things for their life. So We worked as massage therapists on the firefighters, and were able to, one was giving them a massage and the other one was debriefing them. And, you know, it worked out quite well. We were able to really hear their stories, but it was very traumatic for us working on them. And the team then decided that they were going to go to Afghanistan. And I remember when I was taking my training, it was the first time I'd heard the word Taliban. I don't think I could have pointed out Afghanistan to you on a map. If someone had said, what countries border Afghanistan, I would have never been able to tell them. And I'm thinking, Taliban, what is the Taliban? And I remember hearing that going, now that just does not sound like a good place at all. Not ever. Oh, I'm like, you guys are going to, you know, they were talking about, this is before 9/11. They're talking about going to, you know, they'd been there and they think they're going to go back. And I'm thinking, why would anybody want to go to Afghanistan? Are you crazy? You know, and I answer my questions very long.
Good to know.
So I married this really crazy preacher, crazier than a loon. I say this in the book, he says he's not, I say he isn't, so that's, I win. And he was like one of these possessive, you know, you go to McDonald's and it takes 5 minutes longer to go through the drive-thru. So clearly I was having an affair on my way through because, you know, 5 minutes ago your Big Mac was ready. And so I'm like, oh my, he made me crazy. But he was abusive. He was mean. He scared me. And I have children and I've got this crazy husband and, so I seem to pick those, but I looked at him as my own Taliban because I remember thinking to myself, why can I not leave this marriage? Why can't I leave? I'm a strong woman. I'm not wimpy. What is keeping me here? And I remember after 9/11, I watched, because I didn't have a desire to go to ground. I didn't have a desire to go to Afghanistan. There was nothing. I didn't feel anything about Afghanistan. And I'm watching the women. Everybody had to see this, where they get them in that sedan or the Toyota, white Toyota truck, and they're loaded in the back. And I still have a hard time looking at those kind of cars. And they put the woman in the burqa in the back, and they drive them into that stadium. I remember the first place I wanted to go was that stadium. They drive them into the stadium. They make them kneel down. Now, okay, I always found that it was quite odd how the women always got killed for adultery. Somehow the men never got caught. What's up with that? You know, so these women were always guilty, and they would shoot them in the back of the head.
So you knew that about this country before you went there?
Well, I was watching it on TV.
That's why you wanted to go to the stadium.
Well, you know what?
So I want to go back to how you got there. So you got on this plane with this aid group working with. And you get off the plane in Kabul.
Right.
And you are met what sights, what sounds, what smells? What made you feel so connected to a place that was so unlike Michigan?
Well, I remember when I left the house, my ex-husband said to me, I hope you die in Afghanistan. And it was almost like I was fleeing there. There was a part of me that was fleeing there. And I said, you know, I'd rather die there than stay one more minute with you. And it was almost like this connection between the Taliban, him, the abuse. I felt this compassion for these women. And it was almost like in some way I drew strength from them. I didn't understand, but when I got off, you're met with machine guns. There's machine guns everywhere. I mean, you know, it's kind of like how everybody has cell phones here. They have cell phones and machine guns, and it's just an accessory. Can I tell a funny story?
Please do.
So I started this coffee house, right, because I really needed coffee. And I thought, oh, my goodness, Nescafe, one more day, I will die. So I started this coffee house. And we call them shooters, the mercenaries or the private security companies. And they would come in from all different countries. And this group, I think they were like Eastern European or something. They came in all dressed in black. And we had this policy of a no-gun policy in the coffee house. And so those are the rules you have to have. Are we going to let weapons in or not? Well, no, we're not going to let weapons in. So, you know, I go from doing hair, and I go over to my second job of being a waitress. And so I go in, and I see these guys, and they have their machine guns strapped to their back, right? And they got, they're just guns everywhere. And I'm like, yes, excuse me, here's your menus, and can I please take your accessories? And so they go, what? I says, I need your guns. And they says, well, we can't, you know, I'm sorry. I says, no problem. So the next thing I know, I have like 10 machine guns strapped to my arm, and I'm walking, and I put them in the broom closet. I'm thinking, okay, only in Afghanistan.
I can't believe they relinquished them.
Well, that's that or not get coffee.
Well, so now we know the priorities. Yeah. So tell me more. You know, we've been introduced to Afghanistan through the beautiful writing. You know, we've got your book now. We've got Khaled Hosseini's Kite Runner,
Kite Runner
and Thousand Planet Sun. Yeah. And he draws this picture of Kabul, the dust and the food and the smells and the heat and the noise. So talk a little bit about that, how
visual,
that enveloped
you. Want a
you.
Visual? Mm-hmm. Okay. We had two seasons, dust season and mud season. I mean, you've never seen more dust. It literally just covers everything. You leave your windows open. It just covers everything. Everything is the same color. The street, the building, the sky. I mean, it's all this red clay dust. You know, people say, "Wow, what do you love about Afghanistan?" It's the people. Because it's clearly not the dust, because you suffer from upper... It's so much fecal matter in the air. Talk about breathing shit. I mean, you're coughing it up. I mean, it's awful. You have so much fecal matter, upper respiratory infections.
Is this because there's no sewage
open
system?
Sewers.
Ah.
Open sewers. It's a flowing down the street.
So it's not just an animal thing.
Well, and then it rains. Okay, so it's dry. No. It's people think. You know, so the land is dry. Because, you know, it doesn't rain there very often, and it's clay. So the water comes down, and it just goes out into the sewers, and it floods the street. Everything turns to mud, and it dries instantly because it's so dry. And there you go, dust, mud, sewer dust. Oh, it was really, really rough. I mean, I smoked there because I figured, you know, fecal matter, cigarettes, what difference does it make? But I will tell you, I am now living in California. Northern California. This is home for me now. And I stopped smoking because you guys smell so good. This is so weird because I was like, I am not going to cave to the pressure of having to be like everybody else and stop smoking. I stopped because you guys smell good. For the first time, I smelled myself. It's like I could smell myself.
Well, I guess if you've lived with breathing in
fecal matter
and cigarette smoke, this is a good thing. All right, so now you're in Afghanistan with this aid group.
You want to get on the...
Well, no, I'm so anxious to hear about
the
this cultural... Well, and this cultural collision, really, that you describe in your book. Here you are, and you're feeling an affinity for this very strange land from your own, and you find out that your seemingly mundane life as a hairdresser becomes...
Hairdressers never have mundane lives.
Okay, all right. Let's say ordinary.
Yeah.
Thank you. I didn't mean that to be negative. I meant in your run-of-the-mill daily safe, you know,
normal,
one's going to pull a gun usually on you in your shop in Michigan. So here you are in Kabul, and you find this incredible cultural link with the beauty industry for the women of Afghanistan. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I was with this medical team. Oh, I was absolutely worthless because I'm not medical at all. I begged a place on the team, and, you know, I did laundry. And so they didn't know what to do with me because they were doctors and dentists. And they were they were really sweet, but a little staunchy and just didn't quite know why they had invited the hairdresser with them. And I just thought they did not have a mirror. But they were... So... I really, really was useless. And I said, well, would it be okay if I just kind of roam around? And do you believe it? It felt safe to roam around then where it doesn't now. I said, can I just want to roam around? I knew that the Taliban had shut down all the salons. You know, fingernail polish was illegal, toenail polish. open-toe sandals were just like, oh, you know, you're like a prostitute if you wore open-toe sandals with fingernail polish. You just got killed. And it was just really crazy. And I went into, friends of mine found a salon that was open that had just kind of emerged from the rubble, so to speak. And I walked in there. The visual of this, I'll never forget. Can I ask?
Yes,
has
please.
Anybody been to Afghanistan? Kind of? Are you Afghan? Ah, salam alaikum, chatana se hovasi, samilitan hovas. I love to practice my Farsi. Oh, it's like, oh, well, welcome. Oh, it's so nice. I tell you, just going back on this a second, there's two young Afghan girls here. I'm heartbroken every day over Afghanistan. And so if I go to tears, it's because Afghanistan is breaking my heart right now because of what's happening. But anyways, I walked into this beauty salon. Have you guys been to a beauty salon there?
No.
Oh, my goodness. It's about the size of a large bathroom. There's no electricity then nor now. I'm not sure where those billions of dollars went. But anyways, there's no electricity. There's no running water. They're cutting hair with something that looks like hedge clippers. How many people have had a perm? Perm, a lot, okay? They were rolling them with sticks and using rubber bands. I've seen this before, and I'm cool with that. Because, you know, I mean, where are they going to get perm rollers? I mean, Sally's isn't there. You know, you got to use what you got. So this is cool. And then the ladies, and I just kind of barged in, right? And I'm watching them roll this perm. And she's done. The hair's really long. And they put the solution on, and they leave. She left. I'm thinking, okay. My Farsi was horrible. It still kind of is. But I said, I'm trying to say, you need to check that in like 5 minutes. And I finally got a translator because I'm like really confused, only to find out that they just sent them home. And when it dries, they take the perm rods out, and that's it.
To do it yourself?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. You've never seen so much frizzy perms. Now, that is disaster relief. Hairdresser. I mean, a hairdresser could not walk into that salon and see one bottle of color, blonde. So, wait, bleach and blonde color makes orange hair. Not good. So, you know, I'm coming strictly from a hairdresser's point of view, like, oh my God, do you know how much bad hair there's going to be? And so, but the thing is, though, how silly I fell into this, okay? I did not think to myself, wow, let me see if I can change the world. Let me see if I can make a difference in Afghan women's life. I'm thinking, oh my God, this is really, really bad hairdressing. Let me see what I can do. You know, I need to bring some perms here. They need neutralizer, for God's sake. You know, I mean, that's where I was coming from. I will never be I was my humanitarian in a simple way. But you know what I found out, which was so cool and that it happened this way, is that hairdressing, and you can verify this, hairdressing, makeup, hair, and all that is one of the most treasured things for women there. I mean, weddings and engagement parties. These women are the most, they make us look so plain. I have quite a bit of makeup on, and typically, well, they made me put, I'm not these guys, but the Afghan women said that I look like I just got out of bed most of the time. And I had really short hair, not anymore, because like they said, I look like a monkey. So needless to say, I've kind of adapted. But they are so beautiful.
Well, what's the perception of beauty, or what's the perception of the importance of beauty in a male-dominated society? Why was it so important that they maintain these? You wrote in your book that they buried their tools during the Taliban era because they were closing down the beauty shops.
Yeah, and for the Taliban to take that away, because this is not... That was a religious thing, but hairdressing and beauty and the makeup, this is old. This is cultural. This goes back thousands of years. I mean, this is not new. I mean, people said, oh, you brought our Western ways over there. I'm like, no, I did not. I mean, this is old, old, old. They have been doing their eyes. I mean, they use the coal. You know what they would do? They take this, I don't know if anybody's ever seen this. It was an eye infection waiting to happen. But they have coal, and then they dip it in, and they put this on babies, like, brand new, that you spit on it first, and then you dip it in, and you take it, and you close your eye, and you run it across. I had an eye infection every time I did that because it was always somebody else's. But that's, I mean, this is an old technique. Mm. I was amazed at this. And the threading. I love threading. If anybody, any women, whoever want to have their eyebrows properly done, get it threaded. Do not ever tweeze. Do never wax again. Always thread.
All right. Well, now we have to ask what threading is. Sorry, gentlemen.
How many people have had their eyebrows threaded? Oh, see. Ladies, see the ones that have them threaded. It is a technique. I bet you can thread, can't you? Can you thread? You're too young to thread. Really? Oh, you should learn. They put the string in their mouth, and then they twist it, and then they, with precision, tweeze your eyebrows. It's fabulous. Hmm. It's amazing.
So is beauty there for attracting men?
Well,
the marriages are arranged. So is it just a
personal
value?
It's for each other,
value?
For women. It's no. Oh, women really, it can be pretty catty. It's about, you know, you go to a wedding party and, you know, you want to look, what's same here, please. I mean, you go to a party, you don't care what the men think about you, but, you know, the girls, if they're like, you got to outdress them and they're spangly. I'm talking bling. You've never seen bling. I mean, big hair, lots of makeup, and I really didn't know how to dress when I came here because, like, my clothes all had glitter on them. So I had to de-glitter a lot of my clothes.
Then in you deciding to craft the beauty school to kind of help resurrect this long-standing tradition, again, I'm just curious what you saw in these women's eyes who would go to such lengths to risk their lives to keep this going.
Yeah, well, you know, hairdressers, they're my sisters. I mean, first of all, women. These women have been tormented and been abused and been beaten and killed. They were being punished for the crime of being a woman. And now you got women who are actually going out and working. You know, they're working, they're working, they're doing hair, they got a skill, and they have no tools. They have no skill level. I mean, they lost their skill level. They also lost it in their food, because I would have Afghans that would come that, like, had lived here most of their life, or had fled. And they would cook a meal for us, and it was like, oh my goodness, the most tasty food I'd ever tasted. And then we would get the food that we were used to eating, like my cook, unless she just couldn't cook. But it was they had lost the ingredients because of the war. There was things they just couldn't get. So over the years, they had lost the skill of cooking, and they had lost the skill of hairdressing. I mean, because they were fleeing, they were running, their houses were being bombed, their children were dying, women, the pregnancies, they die. These children are being wed at 12 and 13 and birthing a baby at 14. So these women who actually came out and were working and they're using scissors this long, I threw away more in one day in my beauty shop than they probably have in a year. How could I not have compassion for them? You know, watching them trying so hard with no electricity, running water. How can you not want to help? I couldn't. It's like it haunted me. How could I not?
How many women did you have in that first class at the Kabul Beauty School?
20.
And tell us about them. What were their age ranges? What were their backgrounds?
You know, they ranged anywhere from 18 to, like, well, one lady looked like she was 60, but she said she was 32. Mm. So it's hard to say because the Afghans didn't know their age. That's interesting. I never did. They don't know how old they are.
Healthy. Perhaps that's healthy. Not to be fixated on an age.
Right. Maybe. So how old are you? Oh, 20-ish.
I'll go with that.
Yeah, it works. 30-something.
So you had this class of 20 women who had worked in this field before or who were starting over?
Some of them had worked in the field. Some of them had not. They were, you know what? It was the first class. And so what it felt like was, you know how like you have a car and you don't drive it for a really long time and it doesn't start up? Mm-hmm. Teaching was really hard because it was as, you know, they had not had to make decisions, you know, they had not had to use that part of them, thinking, making choices, making decisions, figuring things out. Like just doing the color wheel was just a nightmare. It took forever. And it took a long time to, and this group, once we, you know, got a little maintenance going there, I mean, Bright picked it up. They were, and they did so much better with the technical part. I mean, they could foil, like, they were amazing. They really were hands-on, but some of the learning stuff, because they can't read and write. You know, they did not know how to read and write. So how do I teach them in English? Do I teach them in Farsi? You know, what language? You know, they could maybe speak it, but they couldn't read it. You know, it's
their own language they couldn't read.
Right. Yeah. A lot of Afghans can't write their own language. I mean, because, well, think about it. You have generation, you got a whole group of women that were born into war. I mean, it's been, what, 30-something years? I mean, they said, well, you know, they couldn't go to school because the bombs were dropping or there was fighting in the street. There was, in the house that I lived, there was an archway and it was all blocked in. And I asked, what was that for? They said that was how everybody got from place to place so they didn't have to go out into the street. They could go through everybody's yard to get to the store because it wasn't safe.
We want to take a moment and just remind our listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're speaking with Deborah Rodriguez, founder and director of the Kabul Beauty School and author of the book of the same name. So the absolute intensity it would have taken for these women to come to that school every day and come to the beauty salon every day, what were the conversations like in there?
Okay, so...
But in a male-dominated society... where they had been oppressed, these women had been oppressed, and here they're out, they're about, who knows what it took to get there, but what do they talk about their men? Do they talk about their kids?
Well, you know, the school was a little bit, we always had to be careful because there's a difference between girls and women. The girls are the ones that are unmarried and the women are the ones that are married. And so if you're like 40 and not married, you're still a girl. So...
That's great.
Yeah, right? So they wouldn't mix, like, you know, harsher talking or talk about their husbands or whatever in that arena because they didn't want to. These girls have to go in like, you know, the lamb to the slaughter on their wedding night. And if they don't look terrified, if they have too much information, clearly they were prostitutes. You know, I mean, it was that way. But these girls, like the ones that worked for me in the salon, oh my goodness, they were out of control. I mean, they would just tear up their husbands. They would. I mean, it was exactly the same. And you know, I always thought it was really funny because sex is something you never talk about ever because it really actually doesn't happen, and therefore no, it doesn't. And you know, there's no such thing as sex. I mean, Afghans do not talk about sex. Am I correct there? Yes, sex doesn't happen, and you never know somebody's going to have a baby until it's done. It's like because they don't want to tell. They don't tell you they're pregnant because they're so ashamed. And so my girls, they were just so funny. So they would tease. The other other girls like, oh, yeah, you know, you're getting makeup, you look tired, so we know what happened last night. And it was just, they would just be mortified. And they talk bad about each other's cooking. I mean, it was just, they're joking all the time, all the time.
Do you think that was one of the few places they were allowed to do that, where they could laugh and...
It was a real fun place, you know. I mean, we created an environment for people to laugh.
You know, as a journalist, you're told when you go cover a story, you don't interfere in that story. You don't create the news. It's different when you're an individual and you see a situation. But do you feel that you acclimated more to their society, bringing them the skill set, or do you feel that you brought more of Western attitude along with that?
No, I had to, because, you know, I was married to an Afghan.
Well, we're going to get to that.
Right, we are. I think that I was, I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, I didn't want, you know, it wasn't my place to bring our Western ways there. I wanted to teach hairdressing. But, you know, you can't help but bring who you are there. And I'm not much of a wallflower, and I'm not very quiet. So, you know, but thank goodness they couldn't understand me for the first couple years. So, you know, I could get my faux pas going. But I learned from them. They learned from me. Mm-hmm. We mixed it. And, you know, there's a lot of times I made horrible mistakes, you know. I mean, I was just stupid.
Well, we're getting a couple of questions about this as well. So when you left and you went to Afghanistan, you left an abusive man.
Yeah, I did.
A controlling man.
Yes, I did.
And you went to Afghanistan, fell in love with your newfound home, your culture, and you participated in an arranged marriage.
Should I tell the tea story now?
The tea story would come... Because I have a couple of these questions, and I'm going to combine them, and then you can tell your tea story as you get into it. What is your relationship now with your husband from Afghanistan? I was surprised that you married a man whom you knew for only 6 weeks and didn't speak English under Afghan laws.
What was I thinking?
And you are a second wife.
I am.
All right. Here comes the tea story, folks.
Okay.
I've heard this,
let me tell you this tea story, because then it will clear everything up for you. So I've decided this is the way to clear everything up. So I have menstrual cramps, right? And I'm dying. And the cook says to me, Debbie, oh, Debbie, I have something for you. I give you chai. I'm like, oh, I don't like chai. Can I just... You know, I'll take some, you know, Advil. I'm dying. She says, no, chai, Debbie, please. This is good chai for my marizima. So I'm like, okay. So she gives me this thick, it was like Pakistani chai. It was this, like, really thick, but you could chew it. There was nuts and berries and all this stuff. And I'm drinking it. And I'm like, about 5 minutes later, I'm like, oh, my God, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. My cramps are gone. I'm like, whoa, I'm healed. And I'd been with the preacher for a long time. So I'm thinking, this is fabulous. Wow. So like, oh, maybe a week later, oh, I have such a headache. I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to die. And Shazi says, oh, Debbie, I get you chai. I'm like, the chewing chai? She goes, yeah, chewing chai. I'm like, okay. 5 minutes later, again, gone. I'm like, you know what? I need to be, this is a new business. I can bottle this stuff and I can sell it in America. Everybody will be so happy. The country, all my problems are solved. So my customers are coming in. You know, one has a hangover. The other one hurt her back. One fell off a donkey, whatever. I'm like, oh, Shazia, can you get some chai for these ladies here? The chewing chai, the chewing one. Okay, so she goes... So now, you know, everybody's loving the chai, and, you know, it's like, no, we don't need wine. We'll take the chai, thank you. Only to find out, like, I actually didn't find out till I was here. Someone says, you weren't drinking Shazia's chai, were you? I'm like, yeah. Oh, do you mean the one with opium in it? So let me say, the answer to your question was, clearly it was the chai. Why did I marry someone after 6 weeks? The chai. Why did I marry one with wife? The chai. That's the only answer I have is because I
an arranged marriage. Tell us about what.
Okay,
that was
you
like.
Know what? You got to understand. Really, it was the child. When you're in Afghanistan, it's almost like you're in a vortex of this unreal reality. You don't think quite straight. I think it's the dust. It's the poppy seeds in the air. I don't know, but Cher was nice. I liked him. You know, it's not about love in Afghanistan. You got to understand that. It's a business deal. It's about what can I do for you? What can you do for me? I'm a single woman in Afghanistan. I'm going to live there. And it was before, like now, where you have lots of foreigners there. I could not do this probably by myself.
So you had decided to stay
I decided to stay.
So this was about you solidifying your life in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, people were kept joking, oh, you need a husband in Afghanistan. I'm like, I really didn't think I needed a husband. You know, we met. It was fun. It just seemed, I don't know what, it was the child, I do not know. It just seemed like the natural course. I had two choices. Well, so we kind of dated. We couldn't really date. That was the thing. It's kind of not acceptable. I would be considered a prostitute. His uncle was the minister of Hajj, which is the religious minister. Unacceptable for him to date. Especially a foreigner. His other uncle was this maniac that was the governor that had already killed two of his wives and was probably going to kill him if he got caught dating me. So it was like we had this kind of dilemma of do we never see each other again or do we just get married? I'm like, yeah, what the hell? Let's just get married.
Well, what was that like being married in Afghanistan to an Afghan man? Did it give you entree into more of Afghan society or did it limit you?
No, actually, you know what? The thing is, you know, he didn't speak English very well and I didn't speak Farsi. So that's really quite a good way to do a marriage. I will have to vouch for that. No, it was, you know what it did? It showed the Afghans, and I think you would agree, that I have accepted who they are. I've accepted their country. I've accepted their culture. I love them as a people enough to marry one of their men. And you know, Afghan men aren't the easiest to be married to, right? So the girls are here. I'm not saying anything. But the thing is I didn't know that then. But it did. It gave me a window into a place that maybe not everybody would want to go. It was a harsh window. I mean, when you get sequestered in a room, Debbie, you need to go. This is what I get. Debbie, you need to go into this room because I have guests coming over. Yeah? And I'm thinking, how long do I need to go into this room? Well, the guests are coming over. That would mean, you know, all the men in turbans. And so I'd be sitting there in my room. There's no electricity. Why, the boys are having a party. And I'm here and dancing, and I'm by myself. It's not like I'm in the family home with all the wives.
There's a collision of culture.
Oh,
here. And
yeah.
Then you add in your sons to this mix. Tell us where they were at this time.
Zachary, my son Zach, was actually, I'm going to tell you the truth. I was asked not to put this in the book, but I was never ashamed of this. My son Zachary was a heroin addict. And I did not know this when I went to Afghanistan. I obviously no child starts out that way. And I called my son Noah, and Noah told me, Zachary, we found needles in Zachary's backpack. And I said, okay, I'm bringing him here now. And I basically brought him to Afghanistan and locked him behind walls. And I said, you want to leave? Go right ahead. Taliban are right outside. Knock yourself out. And I did tough love with him. And someone says, oh, that's really bright. You bring a heroin addict to the poppy
opium
capital of the world. I'm like, yeah, well, you know what? You had to get out of the walls first. And he stayed for 6 months. I sent him back, came back for another 6 months. I had him flipping burgers at Camp Phoenix. And
but he had a cultural collision as well.
Oh, yeah,
talk about
did.
That story.
Yeah. You know, Zach, bleeding heart like his mom. And there was a young girl who was basically kind of bought and paid for by this creep that this very slick guy, his name in the book, it's Ollie, we changed the names. This guy was slick. And I saw this young girl, and I thought that was, he kept saying it was his, like, niece or this or that. He had bought the family. There was a family that's so, so poor. And he paid for everything, so he got their kids. And Zachary saw this little girl who was just the most precious child. She's 15, maybe 16 at the max. Tiny, tiny little thing. And she was prostituting her. And he was raping her. And he was making the brother and her have sexual acts together. The brother was 12. And he was raping the brother. And Zach was mortified at this. And he tried to marry her. He was going to marry her. And we were. I said, Zach, you don't need to do this. And he says, I have to get her out. I have to. I have no choice. And basically what had happened was because of Zach trying to marry her, she came in. Her mother and her came into the school one day, and the little girl was so beat up. And this guy had just beat her to a pulp because of Zach. He was so... I mean, we had asked permission from this guy, can Zachary marry her? And he said, yeah. And so we thought it was okay, not realizing, yeah, I didn't really mean yeah. And Zach was... That was really tough on him.
So you found out the hard way that trying to intervene sometimes makes the situation worse?
I mean, you know... Right. I mean, you're not... I always say Afghans will tell you exactly what you want to hear, but it's like peeling layers of an onion, you know? It's never exactly what it seems. You never really know the truth.
And that's kind of the scenario that led you to have to leave.
Right, exactly.
And this is something that, of course, the Kabul Beauty School was still going on when the book was finished.
Right.
So tell us what happened that forced you to leave.
Well, you know, what I found out later, I mean, I didn't know any of this at the time. Basically, what I heard at the time was, Debbie, the Supreme Court is going, Afghan National Security or the CIA, Afghan CIA is investigating your book and investigating you to see if you broke any Islamic laws with the girls. They're going to, you know, and they were just different stuff was being tossed out at me, you know. They says, oh, we're going to see just all kinds of stuff about were you running a business or were you running a school. Oh, they said that the school was a brothel. And then I was said that they decided that it wasn't a brothel, that I was a missionary. I mean, I went from brothel to missionary, boom, overnight. It was amazing. And my girls, it was really kind of funny. My girls were mortified at the fact that they thought they were missionaries, because that's punishable by death. I mean, you don't convert like that. They'll kill them. And they would have rather been prostitutes because, you know, I mean, not that they would have rather been, but I mean, that rumor was easier. And I started getting nervous, and they started talking about different amounts of money that I should be paying to get out of this situation and this and that. Long story short, because I don't know how much time we have. Mm-hmm. Basically, there was an individual and a posse, their posse or whatever, decided that they knew about the book. And for some reason, we're under the impression that you make a lot of money in publishing, which is not exactly true. You have to sell a lot of books. And they decided, they planned this for nearly a year about how to get money. How are we going to work this and extort money?
Now, and who is they? Or is that the problem that you never really know who is who?
I'm not going to name names because I do not have, like, written proof or, you know.
I guess, are these gangs or are these government officials who act as gangs?
These are a combination of people you trust who are connected with the government. The sad part about it is a lot of government that can be bribed. They were going to put me in jail. Here's the scenario, what would have happened. Debbie, they're going to arrest you. You can make, and this, and they had a stack of papers like this of all these charges. You can pay $100,000 and this will disappear. Okay. And I'm thinking, where am I going to get $100,000? And you'll say, well, I have saved, if I sell this, this, and this, I have $20,000. Well, let's see. I think that we could probably, I'll go to my friends. And I can get $50,000 with $70,000. So you pay this money, and you've just given them $20,000 for absolutely nothing, and they split it with the people that had set you up. They could actually throw you in jail, and the same thing. Now you got to bail yourself out. And it's not really, there's just somebody who's paid somebody to throw you in jail. So that, and then that was two, and then when they realized that that I wasn't going to buy into that so well, or that I kept saying I had no money because I had no money, and they kept thinking, everybody kept saying, "Oh, she does too. She has money. She's got money. Oh, Americans have money." Blah blah blah, and they decided that the best way to get this money would be take my son. And so that's when I had already lost $30,000. One of the individuals that I trusted that was a part of this plot, I'd given him $30,000 to secure a building for the school. And it was actually part of my book advance. And I wanted to secure this school so that I never had to worry about rent, you know? And I mean, I've never, ever been about making a lot of money. I've never taken money from the school. You know, money's never been a part of my equation. And so I thought, you know what? If I have this money for the first time, I have actually a little bit of money. So I took this money and I secured the school. Only to find out, because they have this thing called GARO. You can buy a building, you can rent a building, and rent is outrageous. It's like, you know, $2,000-$3,000 a month. Or you can do what's called a GARO, and you give a lump sum of money, and you sign this contract, and it means that after 3 to 5 years, whatever your contract is, you get this money back, or they have to give you the house, or, you know, the building that, they're all houses. And so I found out that same person had forged the GARO, and it never happened, and he took the $30,000. And so basically they decided that that wasn't quite enough money, so they were going to take my son. And so I came into the country on a Wednesday. On Thursday, I got a phone call from somebody, an American woman I trust her so much. She's also married to an Afghan man, and she'd been married for 20 years, and she called me, and she says, Debbie, you are not safe. And she is not an alarmist at all. I mean, this woman could have bombs dropping around her feet. And she goes, well, you know, it's just a little bomb. You know, she doesn't get excited over anything. And when she said, Debbie, it's not safe.
So you got out. We're going to get into what's happening now with the Kabul Beauty School in a moment. But I do want to remind our listeners that you're tuned into the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And we're speaking with Deborah Rodriguez, founder and director of the Kabul Beauty School. A couple of questions are relating to this story that you've just told of how you got out of Kabul, how you ended up here with, you told me earlier, pretty much two suitcases, what you were wearing, and not a lot else.
Shoes and no underwear.
I thought it was better if you described it that way. One question is, how have things changed during the time that you opened your salon until today? So when you got there, it was at the fall of the Taliban, and now we're hearing in the news about the resurgence, although we don't get enough on-the-ground news from Afghanistan, and would you go back if you could?
You know, if I knew who my enemy was and could figure that out, I actually would. But I don't know who the enemy is, and that, I mean, I have ideas. But getting back to the real question of what's changed, it's criminal, what's happened. I mean, the fact that we went in there, what, 2001? Where's the electricity? What happened to the billions of dollars for let's rebuild Afghanistan? Where'd that go? Whose pocket is that in? Because it hasn't been rebuilt. I can promise you that. The roads are still full of mud. The sewers are still full and overflowing. There's no electricity. You get a lot of foreigners in big fancy cars. You know, I mean, when the opium crop, when the poppies are producing 90% of the world's opium and heroin, and how many billions of dollars have been in counter narcotics? Those are my friends, okay? I know these people well. I was at the meetings because we were drinking wine as they were planning their strategy. Come on. Billions. Why? I'm so angry. I'm actually angry because I saw so much waste. I saw people who were doing really good things, making no money, and I saw other people doing absolutely nothing. And you wonder if the Afghans are angry? Yeah, they're angry. They have every right to be angry. We should be angry, too. That's our money.
Well, that leads into a couple of questions. Are any of the NGOs helping, and what are the Afghan people's assessment of the American people? I guess of the government and the people, because sometimes it's not the same view.
Right. I don't know. They're Afghans. It's like, the NGOs. There are some amazing NGOs. I always say, you know, people say, well, what can I do to help Afghanistan? If you're going to give any money, you better check it out first. Check where you're giving your money. Don't just give your money randomly to anybody because you just never know where it's going. Because there's a lot of shady, I'm telling you, those who cannot make it anywhere else sometimes go work in Afghanistan or Iraq. That's just the way it is. There's a lot of amazing people. I know wonderful people working in Afghanistan. There's, you know, CARE, Save the Children. These are fabulous organizations. PARSA, whom we're going to be linked up with, doing a lot of stuff. There's a lot of, I always said there's an awful lot of money in raping a conflict in a post-conflict area. And I hate what's happening to Afghanistan now because, really, we had such an amazing chance to make a difference. And we have failed. The country is becoming a failed state. The Afghans looked at us. They were so happy when we came there. They saw us as like light at the end of the tunnel. You know, the big American flag flying. Yay, the Americans are here. But now it's like they just shake their head. I mean, they don't dislike us. I've never, ever met a rude Afghan, an unfriendly Afghan, never. But the thing is they're tired. We're tired. The foreigners working there are tired. We used to see hope.
Is the Taliban gaining ground because of that frustration with the basic services, the fact that everything is such a struggle? I mean, we saw this, you know, in Gaza and where Hamas was making things happen and the people started voting for Hamas. It became a mainstream political group. Are we seeing the return of the Taliban because folks are just darn sick and tired of living the way they're living?
You know, the southern part of Afghanistan have always been a stronger support of the Taliban. You know, they're recruiting young children. What they do is they build Afghanistan's remote. Okay, you got Kabul. That's like saying the difference between some little town in Arkansas to, you know, San Francisco, the difference. So you got Kabul City, which is totally different, and that's where I was living. You got these remote villages. You get somebody, all they have to do is build a school, you know, give them some water, get water there, you know, and anybody can go in there and teach what they want at these schools. And so there a lot of this recruiting for the Taliban is done in these schools. They teach the children, they arm them, they, you know, I mean, they're feeding them, they're taking care of them, they're treating them good. And so they got supporters. I mean, it's very ethnic there. You know, you've got your Tajiks, your Pashtuns, your Hazaras, your Uzbeks, and it's all tribal. And so they're always, you know, usually, you know, your Uzbeks aren't going to be getting along with the Pashtuns and, you know, this sort of thing. But yeah, you know, I can't tell you why the Taliban is getting more support, but I can tell you that it's failing. I mean, they are, because the infrastructure was never there. We never went through. I don't know what we could have done different, but what we did didn't work. Mm.
Let's go back to, we were talking economics a few moments ago, and we have a question about the economics of the Kabul Beauty School. Well, what is the current situation? The school is closed?
We graduated that last class, so that means we've graduated 182 women. What I've done is, because I wanted to put it, you know, you learn as you get older, right? And so what needs to happen is, the school needs to happen, but it needs to happen in the face of an Afghan, not a foreigner, because I do not think that Afghanistan is going to get better right now. I want to think so, but it's not looking good. So if there's a foreign front there in this school, it's not going to be safe for the girls, right? I mean, I've seen women hung on trees going with a pin on them saying, this is because you work for a foreigner. It's not good. So to keep it very safe, we've decided to link up with an organization called Parsa. We were actually part of them in the very beginning, and they are going to run the school. I can't go back there now, but I can go to Dubai, and I can go into Pakistan, and I can train the women. I have probably 25 teachers already trained. I can start a beauty school in my sleep. So that's the easy part. It's just getting the money in order to start it.
So money from the book is going?
The money, money
rights,
from the book.
Possibly?
Yeah, the movie. Sony, when the contract gets signed, Sony has promised like $30,000 directly for the school. And or 25,000, something like that. And then I give 10% of all my proceeds. That 5% goes to the school, and 5% directly go to individual women. And so that will help. And then I have an organization that we raise money through that. And you know, we're going to open it. And Pars is actually, it's very cool. They're going to start going into the provinces, and we're opening up schools in the provinces and making some of their own supplies and soap so that the women can sell it. Just teaching the whole hairdressing, chemicals, soap, and you know, skin cares and stuff like that they can save from their own products.
We're coming down to the less than 10 minutes, but I have a lot of actual hairdressing questions that I've saved for the end. So we're going to get through all of these.
Okay. So talk fast, right?
All right. What hairdressing tips did you learn from Afghan women that we should know here?
Threading.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
We're back to threading.
Okay. Yeah. Threading and, oh, my goodness, false eyelashes.
Oh,
they look
exotic,
fabulous. Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful. If you ever have in your picture done, do threading and false. Oh, yeah, another thing. We do not take care of our eyebrows. Eyebrows are the frame to your face. Afghans have the most amazing eyebrows, always, always. And so, like, pay more attention to your eyebrows.
All right. How do women there show that they have dressed hair if they're wearing burqas?
Well, they only wear the burqa or the scarf when they're outside.
Outside, okay. So at a wedding celebration when they're...
They're in
men and women.
Clothes. Oh, men, no.
Separate.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they are like in strapless. They're sexy. Oh, way sexy.
Oh, okay. How did you communicate with the women in your school? How long did it take you to pick up Farsi?
You know, well, I called it... Well, Dari is the language, and I called it Darlish, you know? Mm. And it was a combination of English and Dari, and the girls picked up English, and we had Darlish. I couldn't use it outside the compound because nobody else understood me, so we just created our own language.
Did the women want to learn English?
Yeah, we taught English. Mm. Yeah, we taught English every day.
I love
because
this.
You know why? They couldn't read the products. How long do you keep that perm on? How do you know color? You know, 1A, and you know, if they didn't know their letters and numbers, so we taught reading and writing. Basic.
Did they understand proper environmental disposal of some of this stuff, or how to protect
okay,
their own health?
Okay, I'll tell you proper environmental.
All right, I understand that they're open
okay.
source. I just
had to ask. Wait a minute. So we had a pile that we'd take our wheelbarrow down to the corner, and then we just dumped everything, and the sheep would come, the ones that you would be making kebabs with the next day. Yeah, they would graze there, and then you would eat them for dinner. But the ones that you didn't want to eat were the ones that were eating by the hospital. Not good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm, I became a vegetarian.
I can understand why. Considering all the negative stereotypes about hairdressers, a fellow hairdresser and Michigander is here, and wondering if you have a newfound respect for what you do, and do Americans have more respect for your skill now that your book is out?
If this is a Michigander that's here?
Can I see a hand?
Oh. You're a Michigander? No way. From where? Okay. Oh, wow. You know what? I've always kept saying, well, you know, I'm just a hairdresser. I'm just a hairdresser. And everybody kept saying, no, don't say that. You're not just a hairdresser. Because hairdressers are at, before funerals, weddings, I mean, everything. You know, you become like, it's a treasured art. I mean, you have to love people to be a hairdresser. You do. Or if you don't love people, you're not a very good hairdresser. Yeah, it's an amazing job. I would not trade it for $1 million.
What about what's the difference in Afghanistan to the United States in striving for beauty? Is there one perfect look?
Bollywood.
Is there individuality where, you
Bollywood.
Know?
Bollywood.
Give us a verbal description of Bollywood.
Who,
you already said bling.
Who's seen Bollywood? Oh, my goodness. Bling, bling, bling. Big, pew, you know, and what is this like? You know, it's Bollywood. I mean, it's dramatic. It's dramatic. It's over the top. See, anybody know Dubai? You know the Arab look, the whole Dubai thing. It's over the top. It's like, you
but
know.
But is that for special occasions, or what about just daily maintenance?
Oh, well, if you're washing clothes, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But my girls, I did not get it. I stood up. They would come into work looking like whodunit. And then they would get ready. Now they're covering their heads with their scarves. They're putting their long, because they'd come in, they'd wear blue jeans, right? They wore the long jacket, then they had their blue jeans on and t-shirts. They'd take all their clothes off. They had so many clothes on. They take all their clothes off, they had their blue jeans and t-shirts on. They get ready, they put all their jackets back on and their scarf, then they do their makeup. I'm like, wait a minute, why are you guys doing your makeup down? Work is over. Because they're going out in the street, and you know, they're just, they're doing their makeup, and I never could figure out, is this for the bus driver? It's like, what is this about? I'm like, they would all be gathered in the mirror, all of them.
Was that to show that they've got this craft? They're a little bit, there's an elite.
I never could figure that one out. Because they wouldn't wear the makeup, like, at work. But, boy, when they were leaving, they were hot.
Interesting. Was there an economic issue or a class issue about who could take advantage of coming to your salon?
No,
utilizing
it was free.
Your salon? Okay.
Yeah, everything was free. We never.
How about
anything.
Any restrictions at home? Were there certain women? Did you have to be in a more enlightened marriage or home
no,
to come?
No, you know what? We always made sure that it was acceptable with their family mm-hmm. and their husband or their brother or everything, because we didn't want to have them have any problems. We don't want them coming to school during the day and get beat at night.
Having known these women, these people personally, and having seen the lack and the danger, have you adjusted being back here?
No, it's been hard. I mean, ask the people I live with. I mean, how many tears I've shed. I mean, it's been hard. There's no, you know, they talk about culture shock. There's nothing to compare to culture shock going the other way. I was in Afghanistan 5 years. It's been hard because I left like a fire. I lost everything. And so it was like a fire. And so you don't have that happen and it kind of be normal. I mean, I never was actually normal, but it's been I just noticed how beautiful it is here. It's like the curtains came up. It's been 6 months. All of a sudden I'm like, it is so beautiful. This is such a beautiful place. Look at the moss on the trees. How many times do I say, look at the moss on the trees? It's like I had never seen it. So I was living in a fog.
Just the shock of going from that culture back to this.
Yeah, everything. It was whirling. I was whirling for a while. I cried. I missed. It was, take your family away from you. And you can't call them. You can't get a hold of them. You're worried about them. You feel like you're dying inside. You feel guilty because you left, like survivor's remorse, that sort of thing. I cried all the time. I woke up, nightmares. It was, I can't tell you a worse experience other than like losing a child or something like that. I felt like a refugee. I still feel like a refugee periodically. I fled with two suitcases. Everything I owned in my entire life is in Afghanistan to this day. Pictures of my father who died, my grandmother's dishes, that sort of stuff. It's hard. And I miss my girls.
Well, we hope there's a happy ending to this.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. Our thanks to Deborah Rodriguez, hairdresser, founder and director of the Kabul Beauty School, author of Kabul Beauty School, An American Woman Goes Behind the Veil. This program has been part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And we also thank our audience here and also on the radio. I'm Jane McMillan. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than one century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.